Hello there, I am Ren.
And I am Brandon, and welcome to My Dog Ate My Book Report, a podcast where two weirdo 30-somethings take turns introducing each other to a formative book from childhood the other has never read.
However, this is our episode 25 anniversary special, sort of, for us, not for you. But as of recording this, the podcast just hit its one-year anniversary of the episode being released. And also last month, we had its two-year anniversary of the podcast being imagined in our brains.
Yeah. So we're going to break the rules. And we've read a book that we both have already read. And that book is the book that we've based our rating system on, James and the Giant Peach by Roald Dahl.
This comes at kind of an interesting time as well, because there's been some discourse, you know, with the capital D, surrounding Roald Dahl's books and censorship in general, as well as just like a lot of current event chaos surrounding censorship of children's reading material. It is a wild time here in the back end of 2023.
So it seemed like this was a good time to reevaluate this book for a lot of reasons and talk about the journey of this podcast for the last couple years.
On this podcast, we are going to go into detail about the book we are discussing. If you have not read it and do not want the plot spoiled, turn back now and check out a different episode, because beyond this point will be dragons, or giant peaches and centipedes.
Sharks.
502 seagulls.
A lot of animals. An improbable number of animals.
James and the Giant Peach is a kind of dark, extremely absurd little children's book about the titular James, a beleaguered orphan who lives with his abusive aunts in England after the death of his parents. One day, at the height of his misery, a strange old man gives James a bag of glowing, magic, nebulous, worm things with instructions on how to use them to better his situation. Instead, James trips and falls and releases the bag into the garden, at the base of an ancient peach tree, losing all of his little glowing MacGuffins. All was not lost, however, because the magic beans slash worms caused the peach to grow into a ginormous size. It is slightly unclear how large, but the peach pit ends up being a comfortable size living space, so that's the mental scale I'm working with. As well as giving some level of sentience to a handful of garden insects who grow into, like, person-sized. They befriend James, and they all go off to have an adventure in the peach involving tying 502 seagulls to the stem of the peach to get it to fly. They eventually end up in New York City. New York City, where they live happily ever after.
It's a highly specific reference.
That commercial was everywhere. How many people our age can just even like go down the salsa aisle and not think about that commercial?
Honestly, I couldn't remember what the commercial was for. I just remembered the
salsa. It was like, this salsa was made in Mexico. This salsa was made in New York City. And then all the cowboys turn and they're like, New York City. Like, that salsa's bullshit.
Okay.
You can't make good salsa in New York City. All right, fine. Maybe I just internalized that commercial harder than you did. I'm not the only person I know that has to repeat the words New York City whenever we hear them.
I have the auditory memory of the way it was pronounced. I just didn't remember what the ad was for.
I think Pace.
That sounds plausible now that you mention it. Anyhow, we got some content warnings on this one. This book has a decent amount of child abuse, body shaming and fatphobic language, and ableist language.
I do have a question, actually, for you. Is your version the edited version?
No, I don't think so.
Because the electronic versions reportedly were all edited back in, like, February.
I can double check. I just bought the Kindle version. I guess I don't know exactly where the changes are, but I don't think I had a changed version.
If all of those things were true for you, then you probably don't have the changed version.
Yeah, I mean, my version definitely still had a lot of Aunt Sponge being specifically referred to as fat and other synonyms for fat.
Okay. Then yeah, they had edited that stuff. But we'll get into that. It's also, I think, important to note that this podcast does not endorse any of Roald Dahl's views, which were in general very problematic. You can find numerous examples of his racism, sexism, being outspokenly anti-Semitic. It is our policy to not platform authors who are still alive, who have such terrible politics and worldviews. This is not an excuse, but it wasn't until I really dove into him and this topic that I realized how bad he was. So this has been a learning experience all around, and we do not endorse Roald Dahl as a aspirational figure.
So, as we mentioned, we've both read this. It's one of the few books that when we were talking about books that we read as kids and that we really liked or remembered really liking, it was one of the few books that both of us had read. So that's why we rate our books in numbers of peaches. This is the first time I've reread the book ever. I read the book in the third or fourth grade. It was assigned to us. It was just something that I read for school, but I remembered having fun with it. I think I saw the movie first, but the movie was pretty recent, which would have been like 1996-ish then, I think. So yeah, that'd be like fourth grade, probably.
I don't have exact recollection of any of this, but I don't think that it was assigned to me. When I was a kid, if I found a book that I really liked, then I would then go to the library and just sort of like inhale most of the author's additional catalog. The first Roald Dahl book I read was Matilda, which I adored. And so then I went and found like The Twits and this. And I remember rereading this with some frequency, especially when the hubbub about the movie coming out was starting to ramp up. I reread this, and I also have very distinct memories of being in a grocery store and like grabbing this, I don't know, it was like Disney magazine or something off of like the rack and just sitting on the floor of the grocery store and reading the articles about this upcoming movie because I was just so jazzed about this book being turned into a movie. I remember whatever this magazine was that was talking about the upcoming movie had this little section of the article where they were referring to all of the bug characters as if they were like real celebrities and real actors starring in this movie. And so they had like micro interviews with them, but they were absurd. And it was like, Mr. Grasshopper, what is your favorite song? And I remember Mr. Grasshopper said, Jump by Van Halen. So like silly things like that. And I was extremely amused.
That sounds like a pretty classic, like 90s Disney move.
I don't think I internalized a lot of the darkness as being like dark, and definitely never really noticed how rough a lot of Dahl's language was regarding some of the things that we said in the content warning. Like just how often he really drills home that certain characters are terrible because they are overweight. Like, those are the reasons. And he has a habit of that, and it's very troubling. But as a kid, I didn't notice that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like parents dying in a strange incident and then child being kept in, like, a cupboard under the stairs felt so pedestrian as a kid that, like, it was just like, yeah, that's how a story goes. I guess James wasn't kept in a cupboard under the stairs, but you know.
I find that so strange. Here's my micro segue into Ren just being so confused as to why there's this idealization of being a magical orphan. As someone who was an orphan, I just don't understand how people think that is a great trope. And I remember as a kid, like books like this, but then also specifically when Boy Wizard books came out, I would hear people say things like, gosh, I wish I was an orphan so I could go do X, Y, or Z. And in my head, I'm just like, fuck you. But also, what the hell? It happens so often. It's so weird that it's so common. I don't know.
I did find myself wondering as I was reading this where the trope comes from. because I couldn't at the time think of an older book with what feels like sort of the modern version of the trope to me. Of course, if you go back to like fairy tales, there are some where that's basically also what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, like it goes back, like, you know, Cinderella. I don't know. I would really like to know what the trope of the dead parents, where it came from. But I didn't think to really look into that at all for this. I just wrote a note and I was like, why is it? And, you know, when people are playing TTRPGs, I feel like most of the time my friends make orphan characters. And I almost never do. I write characters that have families that are there and are happy. What was it like for you revisiting it? I have a lot of thoughts.
It was fine.
Ooh.
It was fine.
Huh.
I don't think I really have that many thoughts, actually. It just rereading it, I didn't have a lot of specific recollection of anything that happened, aside from just the premise of the peach being huge and the bugs being huge and they fly around on it. I think I have clearer memories of the film, which also just like gives more of a story to the entire thing. I think the thing that like struck me most about revisiting the book is that I kind of feel like there's not very much story to it. It's really just James is in this awful situation. His aunts are awful. He gets magical help to escape, and they fly the peach across the ocean overnight. There's occasions they have to deal with a problem, like how do they make the peach fly? How do they escape the sharks and the cloud men and stuff? But it's kind of, they're not situations that really arise and have nuance to them, I don't think. It's just kind of, a problem arises, the bugs all freak out, James tells them what to do.
That's true.
James' idea works, and then they move on, and then eventually they're in New York, and they all live happily ever after.
That is true. I did ultimately enjoy this book. The notes I have that I took as I was going were things like, wow, this book packs no punches. Immediately, page two, it's all James gets beaten.
Not the sort of casual, neglectful abuse that we see in some other versions of this trope. But just, yeah, he just gets beaten for the misfortune of his parents being eaten by an escaped rhinoceros, which I think is kind of delightful, actually. Not the child abuse part, but like the eaten by an escaped rhinoceros. It's just stated, and then we just don't talk about it ever again, which is pretty great.
I loved the absurdism. So my very boring adult brain took a few minutes to get into this book. Because boring adult brain wanted to creep these thoughts in, like, a rhinoceros can't eat two humans whole. And I had to kind of just, like, box up those rational thoughts and be like, no, you are reading an absurdist book. Put those thoughts over there. And then I would read some more and be like, this is fun. And then boring adult brain is like, that is not enough food.
Counterpoint on the rhinoceros thing. The book doesn't tell us how fast the rhinoceros ate James' parents.
It does, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes, hold on. It's like on page one, so hold on. Let me pop this open. Both of them suddenly got eaten up by an enormous angry rhinoceros. They were dead and gone in 35 seconds flat.
Oh. Well, I forgot about that detail, so my attempt to launch into some kind of, like, Batman-esque scenario where the rhinoceros is like an escaped supervillain who eats James's parents over a series of days while Batman is trying to track it down doesn't hold.
There were definitely just like a couple more points where boring adult brain just tried to creep back in and pull me away from the absurdism. Like, that's going to hurt the gulls. The entire tying up of the gulls to get them to fly the thing. I was just like, you can't give us that much weight on a gull's neck. No. Boring adult brain, go away. Boring adult brain was like, all of these types of animals plus James cannot survive for several weeks on only peach.
I think they crossed the Atlantic in a day. Like, literally, I think it was, like, overnight.
I thought it was a couple of weeks. Am I full of crap?
My general sense was that there weren't really amounts of time passing that weren't covered in the story in some capacity, aside from when everybody was asleep. I think it's like a night or two, because everything else just kind of happens. The movie, I believe, makes it seem like a much longer time, but I'm not sure that the book does that.
I had intended to go in the week since I finished the book and we recorded this. I had intended to go watch the movie, but I ended up not remembering to do that. So I'm very much not colored by any of the movie because I haven't seen the movie in, I don't know, 20 years or something.
Yeah, I haven't either. I generally remember that the movie added a little more depth to the various adventures that they get into.
Yeah, I feel like the movie gets rid of the Cloud Men and adds in Skull Pirates.
Right, there's like pirates. And like the shark's like a robot shark or a submarine or something.
Yeah, well, the art style of the movie is lovely. It's like stop motion. Yeah, they're like paper cutout robot sharks.
Honestly, like, even setting aside my previous feelings about this book, which were fonder than they are now, I feel like Roald Dahl is one of those authors who has very frequently been outdone by the adaptations of his works.
I can't think of any other ones that really blew me away. I didn't like the adaptation of Matilda.
Yeah, I don't have strong feelings about Matilda, but I think Fantastic Mr. Fox is him. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
That Wes Anderson.
You don't say. It's motion. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. It's in the title. The book was just called Mr. Fox, and the movie is Fantastic Mr. Fox because it was so good. That's a lie. And, I mean, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is just better than the book. And also the more true to the book later, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Well, the book is just, like, horribly thinly veiled racism.
That doesn't invalidate anything that I just said.
No, I know. I'm saying, like, the book is just... Ugh.
I'm on the fence about Matilda. I do think I like the book better than the movie, but I haven't read or seen either one for a very long time.
The best part about Matilda the movie was the depiction of the parents. It was Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman, I think, as the parents. And they were phenomenal. So the movie, I believe, was Tim Burton.
Yes.
Because I recall thinking... Oh, they had all of this extra footage of, like, Jack Skellington, and they just put him in a pirate costume? So they didn't have to do the Cloud Man. Maybe that was unkind. I don't know.
I thought James and the Giant Peach was before Nightmare Before Christmas. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'm pretty sure it was... Let me check.
While you're checking that, how do you feel about The Witches? Because that's a movie that you are fond of, I recall.
Holy shit, I completely forgot that was based on a Roald Dahl book. Oh, I love the Witches movie. Oh, crap. Oh, I don't know. James and the Giant Peach film was 1996. Nightmare Before Christmas was 1993.
Oh, wow. That is way earlier than I thought.
If you type into Google James A.N., and then I stopped typing because it gave me everything I wanted. The fifth result down is James and the Giant Peach, Jack Skellington. Oh, my God, I'm right. Oh my God, there's a picture. It is just, they just put a pirate hat on Jack Skellington.
I mean, why not, you know?
Holy crap.
I also remember being fond of the animated adaptation of the BFG.
I didn't see that.
It was like late 80s. I know there was a more recent one that was live action, and I think it was Spielberg or somebody. I haven't seen that one, but I liked the animated adaptation. I think that I got assigned a lot of Roald Dahl books in school over the course of elementary school, and I think almost always there were ones that had adaptations that we then promptly would watch, because that's how being assigned reading in elementary school is you read the book and then you watch the adaptation so that the teachers can kind of like not have to manage the kids for the duration of a film.
So I get the sense that maybe this reread kind of killed the magic for you.
I don't know. I just wasn't as fond of it.
I didn't, you know, end up, like, absorbing it in one session, which I thought I probably would, because it's such a short little book. But I had just so much going on in my brain that I couldn't really focus.
Yeah, I think I just was hoping for more. Or I was remembering there being more to it, which is probably the movie's fault.
Who was your favorite character? And did that change since you were a child?
Honestly, I couldn't really tell you who my favorite character would have been as a kid. I don't have a strong enough recollection of having an outright favorite. It probably would have been the grasshopper. I don't know why. I just think that's true.
The grasshopper was my favorite character as a kid. I don't know. I had this like affinity for like kind, gentle, older British-y guys, I guess. And I remember thinking the centipede was annoying and a jerk. But this time I loved the centipede. He was my favorite this time.
The centipede was good. I think I liked the earthworm a little better this time through than the centipede, but they're both good. The earthworm just constantly doesn't like what's happening.
That is true. He's very concerned. I'm trying to remember who his voice actor is from the movie, because I feel like I recall him being someone famous.
I feel like the cast from the movie was pretty decent, as I recall, but I couldn't tell you who any of them were.
Oh, David Thewlis.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Centipede is Richard Dreyfuss. Okay.
Because the Centipede the movie was kind of like a street tough.
Yeah, he was like this like cad kind of guy.
Yeah, he had like a flat cap.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he like literally had a cigar, but I feel like in my heart he had a cigar.
Oh, he did, I think. Yeah. He has a Brooklyn accent in the movie, which kind of baffled me because everyone is supposed to be a British bug.
I mean, centipedes are native to Brooklyn, of course. They only came to the British Isles as an invasive species.
I found him delightful, I think primarily because of the leg thing. It was like, I have 100 legs. I'm called a centipede. Obviously, I have 100 legs. Everyone's like, no, you've got like 42. And he's just like, nope.
I do think that was a funny shtick.
And how he couldn't do anything without like taking off his boots or putting them back on again. And he had the songs. The songs were great. Some of them had some rough bits in them, but the songs were like pure Roald Dahl nonsense. Yeah, okay. Well, do you feel like there's anything else that we really like super have to talk about?
To be honest, I don't have much else to say about the book. I don't want to like rush you away from discussion of the book. I just genuinely have very little to touch on.
Other stuff to talk about. We've got, you know, the entire 2 years of this podcast to talk about. So I did a little bit of cursory looking into Roald Dahl because we like to give background information. This will be brief though, because Roald Dahl, you know, most people have heard of him. He's a rather prolific British children's book author. He was born in 1916. He passed away in 1990 of cancer. He was born to rich parents, and he had a very comfortable life. And he was a terrible person, so I don't really feel like I need to hype him up anymore or give any more of his just, like, prestigious biography or whatever, because he was just a rich white guy who hated people that were different than him. The end. I met his daughter once. She's a terrible person.
Oh, no.
She's still alive, so I don't know. Am I allowed to? There's no way she's ever going to hear this. Okay. I was working in a pet store, and this was maybe like 15 years ago. And I was in kind of like a suburb of Massachusetts where there were a lot of rich people. And I don't remember what she wanted, but she came in wanting to do some sort of special order that we couldn't do. And she was one of those white ladies that immediately reverts to, do you know who I am? And I wasn't a cashier. I was like one of the people working in the back, working with the animals. And I came up because I heard yelling at the stage where it was, you know, do you know who I am? And the cashier, who was like, you know, this high school kid, was just like, I don't know who you are, ma'am. I'm really sorry. And she's all like, I'm Roald Dahl's daughter. Except, you know, she had a British accent, which I'm not going to do. I'm not going to hurt you all. And I ended up kind of like booting her out of the store for berating the poor high school student. And then I had to explain to the high school student who Roald Dahl was. And I'm like, I don't even know what his daughter is doing here in Massachusetts, but sure, whatever. Like, don't let rich white people push you around, kid. Sorry. Yeah, so that's my brush with celebrities, meeting Roald Dahl's terrible, snobby daughter who, you know, Karen'd her way into yelling at a high school student cashier at a freaking Pet Supplies Plus. Job I had for a little while I was doing the unpaid internship circuit when I was working with zoos. Because that's what you gotta do. Work retail to get through unpaid internships. America!
And I have to imagine that zoos have a moderate amount of turnover, not least because of the risks of being eaten by a rhinoceros.
So, Roald Dahl had a contract where during his lifetime, publishers were not allowed to change, and this is in quotes, so much as change a single comma in one of my books. Roald Dahl's dead now. In February 2023, after a long, many-year sensitivity reader journey, Puffin released edited versions of most of Roald Dahl's catalog, softening language to do with racism, sexism, ableism, fatphobia, things like that. The things that were relevant to this book were, and I'm quoting here, the centipede songs in James and the Giant Peach that were changed. They changed tremendously flabby Aunt Sponge to more general lyrics about them just being like nasty and frightful. There was an example in The Fantastic Mr. Fox where a character was hopping about like a dervish and they changed it to hopping around like a frog. Things like that. Took out a lot of uses of the words like crazy and mad, anything to do with like, you know, low intelligence and mental disorders. Changed a line in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory about a character being shut up in some disgusting sanatorium. Removed references to physical deformity and disability. Things like that. People threw a fit. It was all that was happening on book Twitter earlier this spring. Mostly people being mad that they did that. And the backlash was so extreme that Puffin actually kind of rolled it back. And they had to go and release the Roald Dahl Classic Collection alongside the revised books. And I was curious what your opinions were on that.
My general feeling, and of course this is not the first time that we've talked about books that have been edited, since both the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew were arguably more heavily. I find myself feeling that those two situations are different. I'm kind of like, good on them for fixing the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. I think because those were like work for hire sort of things. They're like these brands, basically, more so than an author, right? Whereas with the works of an individual author, I find that I'm not generally in favor of censorship in this manner. That comes with the caveat that I don't think that works that have this kind of language, certainly enough to be the subject of a significant censorship push, necessarily deserve to remain as widely spread as they are, right? I'm kind of like, let Roald Dahl's works be what they are. If we're concerned about sensitivity, that can be addressed with, you know, a note in the book or something like that. I think that trying to sweep it under the rug, just try to like sanitize it, whitewashes the problems.
I see where you're coming from, and I don't like totally disagree, but I suppose I'm on team. I think the corrections are good. And I think so specifically because of how Roald Dahl books are still pushed in schools. And because all of these books are still pushed in schools, I feel like they've become larger than Roald Dahl. And they're no longer, I don't know, you know, like just his voice. They become a thing that schools and teachers are promoting.
Right.
And in that situation, it's going to feel really crappy for, you know, kids who are overweight, or kids who are, you know, Jewish, kids who are any of these things that he puts forth as a negative. These kids are going to feel like crap, possibly, you know, when they read them, because the teachers in the schools are putting forth these books as the pinnacle of child book excellence, but there's all this hurtful content in them. So that's my opinion. But I do ultimately think that you're right, where maybe they should just stop being pushed. And I think my favorite quote that I saw about the whole thing was Philip Pullman, who is a delight.
Yeah, he's great.
He suggested, when everyone was talking about whether or not they should be edited or not, he just said, Dahl's work should just fade away in favor of promoting authors such as Phil Earle, S.F. Said, or Francis Hardinge. Instead, he's just like, let Roald Dahl's work die. Don't edit it, whatever, just stop promoting it. And here's, like, better authors. But people aren't going to do that. They're going to keep pushing these books in schools. And I can't help but feel like I want the kids that are made to read these to not feel like crap.
Yeah, and that's a pragmatic view that I can get behind. The ideal situation for me would be what Pullman suggests, that we just put the spotlight on other works instead. But yeah, realistically, you are correct. That's not going to happen.
I do understand that saying that in this situation, I'm like, yay, censorship good, could read as, I think, yay, censorship good for children's books in general, when I absolutely do not feel like it's the same thing at all. Because we could, you know, parallel this with currently libraries and schools are fighting, and in a lot of situations, fighting a losing battle against parents who are trying to censor and pull books that promote inclusivity, you know, gay rights, Black Lives Matter stuff, like all of that stuff. And parents are saying, like, this is inappropriate material for kids. And I don't agree with censoring that stuff. But I feel like the situations are very different in my head, because the reasoning for censoring these books is kindness and not hurting marginalized people. And the reason for censoring those other books is to specifically marginalize people more.
The other thing that's kind of different is that they're not about changing words in books, they're about banning books from being available. Not just banning them from being taught, but banning them from being available in school and in some cases public libraries. Which is, of course, a much more drastic thing than changing some words in a book. I don't think that we should ban the original text of Roald Dahl books. Even if I wish that we would not teach them over other works that maybe are better, more deserving, etc., I don't think that we should, like, kick all Roald Dahl books to the curb and just not make them accessible. Because I don't think we should do that with books. Books should be available. If kids want to seek them out, I don't think we should pretend they don't exist. There's a big difference between public libraries will get defunded if they have the perks of being a wallflower on the shelves, and James and the Giant Peach now says mean instead of fat, you know?
Yeah. I felt the need to put that in there because I see a lot of people doing the whole, like, slippery slope thing where they're just like, well, if you censor Roald Dahl, you must be in favor of censoring all of these books, like, in libraries. And it's like, no, they're for wildly different reasons, and it's absurd to me that I have to explain this to you, that, like, I'm in favor of kindness, not like being mean on purpose. I don't know. It just kind of blows my mind a little bit.
I think part of my reticence to prefer the censoring Roald Dahl or editing Roald Dahl, perhaps, part of my anxiety about that is probably a little bit an anxiety about publishers, which are, you know, major corporations, ultimately, having the ability to just change the things they publish, right? I do think that there's a slippery slope argument to be made there, but I don't think it's that slope. I think it's the slope of what even is authorial ownership in a legal and business sense. And, like, what can publishers do with authors' works?
We came across this in a small degree, I think, with The Cricket in Times Square.
Right.
Where they had the two chapters that were about the main character going to Chinatown, and they had them rewritten by a Chinese-American author. And I think for the same sort of reasons, because, you know, this book is going to continue to get pushed in schools, and they wanted Asian children to not feel like crap when they read it.
Yeah, you're right. I had forgotten that that was also a thing we had talked about, and I was definitely in favor of those changes. I think those changes made the book stronger in many ways, and not just removing potential harm.
I mean, if we're only exclusively talking about James and the Giant Peach, I think that it is very uncomfortable how often Roald Dahl mentions weight in this book. And it's very clear that the bad characters are bad because they're awful people and they beat children. And that could be highlighted way more than, you know, physical attributes that they have no control over being added into the negative. So I don't feel like it hurts anyone to take those bits out and emphasize that, you know, Aunt Sponge is just a jerk because she's a horrible person. And she's not a horrible person because she is fat. Like, it hurts nobody to make those changes. And it may alleviate hurt, you know, if this book is assigned in school and some little kid is just like, oh, well, I'm overweight. That must mean I'm terrible. You know, I don't know if people think like that. But, you know, I've definitely had situations where, you know, a book or a movie or something talks about said attribute as being awful. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm said attribute. Well, now I feel like crap. It's complicated, and I understand it's complicated. That's why I thought it was interesting to talk about. How many of Five Giant Peaches would we give this book? And this is the season finale of season two. Are we going to keep using the peach system?
I feel like this was a very middle-of-the-road book for me. So I'd give it like 2.5.
I feel like this gets a four giant peaches for me. After I shut up the rational, boring adult version of me, I found the parts of the book that I remember being like the magic, you know? But as is my habit, I dock points for problematic crap. And so he gets a whole point docked off for being Roald Dahl. So that being said, I feel like this might be the end of the Giant Peach era for me personally. I don't know if you agree.
I'm okay with that. I don't know what we'd use instead.
I don't know what we'll use instead either. We've got a little bit of time to figure that out. This is the end of season two.
We will find out eventually what we're going to rate things in. But speaking of rating things, this is our 25th episode. We've read 26 books for this podcast so far.
26?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we've actually read 25.
No?
Because episode 10 was Ghost Rider.
Oh, you're right.
Episode 5 was watching a bunch of movies.
We've read 24 books for this podcast and watched 2 films and 1 multi-part television adventure.
We actually watched 1 film and 2 multi-part television adventures. I'm just being an asshole today, I'm sorry.
Anyway, we have recorded 25 and a half episodes because we're not finished with this one yet.
Yeah. So, you know, this episode, as of the point of recording, we have been releasing episodes for over a year. We have been imagining this podcast being a thing ever since October 25th of 2021. I dug up our Discord history. I sent you a message that just said, I have a wacky idea, but I need to get home to type it all out. And you said, okay. And I said, okay, I'm sitting in my driveway. Now, this is just an idea that has sprung fully formed into my mind while driving in the rain, so it might not be a good idea, but it's got me excited, so maybe you and I start a podcast. And that is that. I took a screenshot, and I'm going to put it in the show notes. So, history, folks. But you have some questions for me, for both of us.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to pose to us what books we have most enjoyed revisiting for each of us, and which ones we have most enjoyed discovering for the first time, since those are the two parts of our podcast experience. And I have racked my brain about what I would say for the book that I have most enjoyed revisiting, because there's a lot of them that I've enjoyed very much revisiting. Some of the books that I've submitted, at least, are books that I've read many times prior to this. So things like Dinotopia, I have read many times. And so by the time we read it for this show, I knew I was going to love it still, because it hasn't been that long since I read it before. So I think in the spirit of kind of the podcast and what we're trying to do with it, I have instead thought about which of the books that I chose I hadn't reread for a long time, or possibly ever reread. And, you know, I think I do super, super love from the Mixed Up Files with Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, still in a way that I didn't expect. But I think the thing that most pleasantly surprised me to revisit was the Caves of Steel. That's the one that I think, revisiting it, I most enjoyed in a new way. In a way that I hadn't enjoyed it in past readings, in some cases because I wasn't really engaged in the same parts of the book anymore as a younger reader. And I you know, then went and reread the other two in that trilogy and liked them all, and they're books that I now have a lot more fondness for than I did before we did Caves of Steel for this podcast. So I think that's kind of like the big, like, success story, I guess. The revisitation that has most made me, like, rediscover a book in a way that is, like, even better than I had in my head before. So what about you? What have you loved revisiting?
In terms of revisiting, I'm struggling a little bit because I do kind of feel like ultimately I have killed a lot of the magic for myself and a lot of my picks. I opened up our document where I have been tracking our rankings so far, and by and large, I have ranked my picks very low. The highest ranking that I've given something that I have already read has been this book that we just read, James and the Giant Peach. I feel like this book made me remember a little bit of the magic of discovering sort of absurdist writing for the first time. And I know we didn't really go into too much of that when we were talking about the book, but there's just so much in this book that you just have to suspend your disbelief about the way the world works and gravity and physics. Things just happen. A peach can just fall out of the sky and get impaled on the Empire State Building, and everyone will just be like, cool, you're a hero now.
Yeah, and to just accept all of these giant bugs into society.
I think before I read this book, I really didn't know that it was okay to just write absurdist stuff. But if we're taking this one sort of off the table because Roald Dahl's a terrible person.
I mean, I think it's on the table. I think you're allowed.
I do feel like one of my strongest, most visceral experiences of revisiting something was Z for Zachariah, just because of the just terror grip that that book still had on me when I reread it. I wouldn't say that was necessarily an enjoyable experience, but it was very strong. So it's hard for me to answer this question.
That's fine. I mean, I essentially answered it with three books.
I did love Hatchet. I didn't actually write down what my ranking of Hatchet was, but I think I ranked it quite high, with the caveat that you need to read it back to back with Brian's Winter to really get the whole thing. What was your favorite thing that I forced you to read?
I really enjoyed Z for Zachariah. It was not what I expected, but I liked it a lot. As you said, it's not the easiest read, but that's okay. So I enjoyed that one. I have a hard time debating whether I like that more or less than... And this is a weird one to choose, I feel like, but I kind of really liked Pet Sematary.
I thought it was going to be that.
and I guess really what I think I actually mean is that I kind of really liked Stephen King. Mm. Because as I talked about in that episode, I have never read any Stephen King otherwise, aside from On Writing, which is nonfiction. And I had largely kind of written him off because his books are so long, and I don't tend to like reading books that are super long. I usually lose interest well before the end of a 600 or 800 or 1,000 page book, usually. But, like, I don't know, Pet Sematary kept me moving, and even though there are parts that weren't awesome, it did get me actively interested in seeking out other Stephen King books, especially some of the ones that you've recommended to me.
Hey ho, let's go.
And I haven't done it yet, but, like, that's definitely been kind of the surprise for me. And I think some of that is because I went into that expecting to just not like reading Stephen King. I didn't have any preconceptions about like Z for Zachariah or whatever, aside from just not knowing what it was going to be about. But I had a lot of preconceptions about what Stephen King was going to be like. And mm-hmm. I found that it was like way more readable and engaging than I expected, especially considering that
it's a long book.
that you were like, Pet Sematary is not the best one, but it's like the formative one. You know, you justify your choice of that versus some of the mm-hmm. Stephen King that you actually like better. So
it's difficult for me to answer this question for the books that you've introduced me to, because some of your selections have just been so good that I've continued reading the series, if they belong to a series, onward. Actually, all three of the ones that I feel like are my top are all series. Caves of Steel being one that I ranked just flat out of 5. I was delighted. I took a little bit of a break after reading The Naked Sun, but actually this week I started reading Robots of Dawn, the third book in that series again. And I'm back in the world of Bailey and Daniil, and I love it. It's so good.
And it's fitting to take a break because Asimov took like a 25-year break between The Naked Sun and The Robots of Dawn.
That's fair. The other one is obviously Animorphs. Like, we knew I was going to love Animorphs, and I kept going with that series. And also shout out to Animorphing Time podcast, which I started listening to after each book that I finished in that series. They're delightful. And then Dinotopia, which is also a series which I now have most of. All three of those, for very different reasons, were just absolutely magical, delightful books that made me really enjoy the act of reading something and left me wanting more, and I think held up really well.
I was frankly very shocked that you had never been exposed to Dinotopia before. I find that a lot of people don't super know about the robot series, so even though I know you like robots and everything, I wasn't super surprised that you hadn't encountered those. But like, Dinotopia blew my mind that you would never, knowing that you are a dinosaur enthusiast.
You know, I would say, like, maybe I mistook it as, like, a dinosaur encyclopedia or something, and so I passed it by. But that also doesn't make any sense, because I read dinosaur encyclopedias on the regular. I don't know how I missed it. I don't. It doesn't make any sense to me.
It's been super fun to share stuff with each other, I think.
My hope is that, you know, maybe in season 3 onwards, I will finally make a selection that you love. But what I'm finding is that I read a lot of garbage just because I read what I could find. And I viewed a lot of things as formative that were not particularly good.
I wouldn't characterize your picks as garbage.
Some of them have been not good.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. You asked very nice questions. What is your least favorite book that we have read in this podcast?
I wasn't gonna go there because I was like, what? Let's keep it positive. But okay, let me think. Just least favorite book
that we've done. Just least favorite. It doesn't matter if it's yours or mine. My answer, I think, is Little House in the Big Woods.
It's down there, but I think I like Lost on a Mountain in Maine less.
Oh my god, I forgot that one. Actually, no, that one was the worst. I just didn't have that on the list because it was a guest episode.
It's just objectively less good, Hatchet.
Lost on a Mountain in Maine is terrible. You're right. It was less good than Little House in the Big Woods. That's why that episode had to be censored so much. Because we kept swearing about how bad it was. 80 pages of nothing.
That's the book that provoked me into retaliating with Flatland.
Okay, Flatland wasn't bad, though. It was just...
Yeah, it was...
hard to read.
I was expecting to dislike Flatland. I don't know if I like it.
It was good brain exercise, for sure. I felt vaguely smarter for having read it. Maybe not smarter, maybe just that, like, I'd exercised my brain a little bit.
Edward Abbott.
A square, excuse me, A square.
Walks into a room and just like says a nonsense phrase, and then you just have to think about it for like 20 minutes. That's basically the experience.
Yeah, well, you know, this has been episode 25 of this ridiculous journey with the two of us. And thank you for being my podcast partner.
No, thank you for also that.
There will be a short break between this season 2 finale and the start of season 3, mostly because I'm going back to school.
I just moved.
Yeah, Brandon just moved. We're going to give ourselves just like a little bit of padding in terms of edited episodes lined up and ready to go in case I end up, you know, in like final exam situation and just having a gap in recording time.
We're also kicking off season 3 with a slate of guest episodes, just a run of like 5 guest episodes. And those always take a little longer to get organized and edited and stuff because there's more than just the two of us involved. So we're going to make sure that we have those well in hand.
We're just turning this podcast into, we're just getting our friends to come on and show us books that both of us missed.
Yeah.
Is the gist of it.
Which, you know, there's a lot of books we missed. Turns out there's a lot of books.
And we're starting off with the first episode of season 3, a book that we've lamented on this podcast that neither of us have ever read before, and we really, really wanted to finally give it a go. And our friend David Pickering introduces us to Redwall. Spoiler alert, it is magical.
I feel like we both have separately become very familiar with the experience of people being like, you didn't read Redwall?
Mm-hmm. Especially considering how much Mouse Guard we've both played.
Well, we're both the kind of people who, like, when people see us walking down the street, they say, that's a person who read Redwall as a child.
Yeah, especially when I'm wearing mouse ears.
My Dog Ate My Book Report is produced and edited by the hosts Brandon and Rin, each of whom can be found on Twitch as Picarito and Rin Out of Time, respectively.
The music used in this podcast was licensed by Epidemic Sound, and our icon image was illustrated by Cindy Lau.
Have a question or comment for the team?
You can find us on our website, which links to all of our socials at dogatemybookreport.blueberry.net. Blueberry does not have any E's, or by emailing us at dogatemybookreport@gmail.com.
We'd be super excited to know what books you loved growing up and what adaptations of Roald Dahl you think kick the book's ass.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm going to end this off with one of Centipede's songs, which I'm not going to sing, but I'm going to read it out loud just because I did find it delightful. We may see a creature with 49 heads who lives in the desolate snow. And whenever he catches a cold, which he dreads, he has 49 noses to blow. We may see the venomous pink-spotted scrunch who can chew up a man with one bite. It likes to eat 5 of them roasted for lunch and 18 for supper at night. We may see a dragon, and nobody knows that we won't see a unicorn there. We may see a terrible monster with toes growing out of the tufts of his hair. We may see the sweet, little bitty, bright hen, so playful, so kind, and well-bred, and such beautiful eggs, you just boil them, and then they explode and they blow off your head. A new rhinoceros, surely you'll see, and that enormous and gnarable gnat, whose sting, when it stings you, goes in at the knee and comes out through the top of your hat. We may even get lost and be frozen by frost. We may die in an earthquake or tremor. Or nastier still, we may even be tossed on the horns of a furious dilemma. But who cares? Let us go from this horrible hill. Let us roll, let us bowl, let us plunge. Let us go rolling and bowling and spinning until we're away from Old Spiker and Sponge.